The whole boundary controversy, of course, interfered with the process of settlement of the Aroostook County. So long as the territory was in dispute, the question of ultimate title to the lands was a discouraging factor. On the other hand, the state's eagerness to obtain title to the land encouraged them to investigate the territory and drew attention to the favorable aspects of the territory, the extensive stands of timber, especially the pine, which is becoming so scarce in the estimate, the probable fertility of the soil, for example. And some of the crises in that long controversy also affected the actual movement of people into the territory. The Baker crisis of 1828, for example, convinced Washington that there ought to be a garrison of regular U.S. Army troops posted on the frontier to help maintain peace. And thus, the garrison was established at Houghton in 1828. The army found that they needed a road for the transportation of goods and supplies and even the movement of troops into that post, and consequently the first road into Aroostook County was largely built by the troops in 1828. And this was extended up as far as the stream in Monticello in 1833. The Aroostook War resulted in the squatting, they called it, of a road up through the woods farther west, striking the Aroostook River in the area where Oxbow and Ashland now are, and this eventually became an important road also. The men who came into Aroostook as part of the posse were the militia. The Aroostook War were often attracted to the land and returned as actual settlers. The importance of the settlement of the boundary controversy by the Webster-Ashburton Treaty in 1842 is indicated by the fact that the population jumped from 7,000 in 1840 to 12,000 by 1850. And the population continued to grow after 1850. Some of these people who moved into settlement from southern Maine and the rest of New England, some were English-speaking people who moved in from New Brunswick, often descendants of loyalists. Some were Irish or Scots, or Scots-Irish who moved through New Brunswick into Maine. A little later on, there are some French-speaking people from Quebec who moved in to work in the lumber camps and the lumber mills and in Stockholm and in Ashland, for example. The population of this day had not grown as fast as the leaders had hoped in 1820, or the population of Aroostook. And so the leaders of this state were persuaded by a very active man, W.W. Thomas Jr. of Portland, to subsidize the creation of a colony of Swedish immigrants in Aroostook County. The end result is the colony of New Sweden and the adjacent Swedish-speaking town of Stockholm, and the settlers moved into Westmanland and Poplarwood and nearby. This unique colony has attracted a lot of attention, and much has been written about it. We might say that W.W. Thomas Jr. had been a consul in Gothenburg, Sweden. During the American Civil War, and had become active in encouraging the migration of Swedish people to America, and conceived the idea that they would make good, sturdy farmers for the northern climate of Maine, rather like that of New Sweden, of Sweden itself, he thought. And so he persuaded the state legislature, when he returned to the United States, to set aside a township, realistic county, which would be given in homestead lots to real settlers from Sweden. And he himself was given the task of going over to Sweden and rounding up the people who would be the first settlers. And so some 50 people arrived in the summer of 1870 to be the very first settlers. And then the next few years, while he was at the Commission of Immigration, some 3,000 Swedish people in all came to settle in this area. Heuristic did not grow faster than it did because of the contrary pull of the American West for the attraction of would-be settlers, and possibly because of the contrary pull of jobs in the cities and in industry for young sons of Maine. Economic progress and prosperity were hindered by the transportation problem of an inland county, the difficulty of getting goods out to American markets. And this would be true until the railroads finally came in the 1890s, as we shall see. Another factor, possibly after 1850, which affected the growth of population in the Heuristic and the activities of settlers and agriculture, is the fact that a large amount of the land fell into the hands of lumber company, or was granted to lumber companies and railroad promoters or other speculators, from whence it went to lumber companies, especially in Western Heuristic, which never has been much settled. Lumber remained an extremely important industry, of course, for our Heuristic County. The pine lumbering at first, spruce later, hardwoods for veneer, for example, more recently emphasis on pulpwood for the paper industry. Some of this lumbering was intended for a market by way of the St. John River itself. Later the railroads took a good deal of the lumber out to market in the United States. And of course, some of the lumbering in the westernmost regions of Heuristic County went by way of the Penobscot River system to Bangor and American markets. The lumbering industry, particularly like in the lumber camps and so on, is very well covered by tapes in this set of historical tapes, and so it doesn't seem necessary to comment further on it in this introductory tape. What we might turn to now is a discussion of what Heuristic was like for the settlers in frontier days, in pioneer days. And the basic picture is that of a pioneer intending to be a farmer, who came with a little bit of capital, perhaps, a few tools, the most important one would be his axe, and an ox or two, perhaps a horse or a cow. He looked around for a good piece of land not claimed by somebody else. He took whatever steps were necessary to acquire claim to the land. This varies from simply squatting there without anybody's permission, as the first settlers on the Heuristic River certainly did, or buying a lot from a proprietor of a township, if there were proprietors, or buying it from some other landowner or speculator, or possibly taking out a land grant from the state, which set aside certain townships as settling land. The state's term for settling land by the middle of the 19th century was very lenient. A settler could get 100 acres of land, good farmland, at 50 cents an acre, payable in work on the local roads during the next few years, providing that he actually lived on the land, cleared 15 acres of land, sowed 10 of it to grass or crop, and built a house within 5 years. It was thus possible that he had 100 acres of excellent farmland, the most fertile land in the state, without paying any cash. In fact, this was a homestead policy before the national government established such a policy. The settlers' next task was to clear away the trees. Many of these were large trees, so this is virgin forest we're thinking of. Often, of course, many of the tall pines, which originally made these lands so valuable, had already been stripped away before the settler arrived, either by license or by illegal lumbering. Such lumbering could be done until a man had complete title to a lot. Real settlers often saw the huge stumps and other remains of the early timber cutters. The settler was occupied felling the trees and cutting them into logs for much of the summer and fall of his first year. In the following spring, usually, these logs were piled and burned. The choppings, they aren't clearings yet because the stumps are still there, were often described as pillars of smoke by day and pillars of fire by night when the burning took place. If a man were lucky enough to get a good burn, he could then begin to till the soil. The seeds for his first crop were often dropped in among the ashes and stumps in his little clearing. Later the stumps could be burned or grubbed out. But this first season or two, it was important to get seeds into the ground. There are accounts even of settlers dropping the seeds onto the snow and letting them melt into the ground. Late springs and wet weather, late frost, all these made it difficult for the land to be cleared and for the crop to be started. Apparently, a man did well to clear 5 acres in one season with all of the other things he had to do in beginning a farm and building a home. When you read of a man who had 50 acres of cleared land, a new pasture or crop, you know that either he or his predecessor had been on the land for a long time, unless it was flat land along a river where more grasses sometimes grew. The first houses, barns, were usually made of logs. And if a man with capital began near a village which had a sawmill, he might afford to put up a frame building right away, but very few did that. Possessions were few for most families. Life was rude and simple, and there were the basic problems of getting in the crop with the bread that the growing season might be good. There was work of cultivating the crop with hand labor, with the help of oxen or horses, the getting in the harvest. And then there followed the long, hard winter. Much of the clothing in the early days of flax and wool, spun, woven, and sewed right on the farm in these pioneer days. Much of the furniture would also be made at home. Blacksmiths, shoemakers, other craftsmen would be found in the villages early. Sawmills and grist mills were the first and perhaps the most important industries to be started. The state gave special grants to men who had established mills, and around them the villages often grew up. Presque Isle, for example, grew up around Mr. Fairbanks' mill. As soon as possible, the settlers would acquire livestock, pigs, cows, sheep, oxen, horses, chickens, and a good deal of the food was provided from their own livestock. Some of the settlers have earned part of their living by hand-hewing shingles from cedar that grew on their own land, or sometimes cutting the trees and selling them for lumber, or working as loggers in the woods for other woods employers. This would sometimes mean that they would be late in returning to the farm in the spring and late in getting their crops in, so it may have been a hindrance to them in some ways. The markets for their crops, other than what they raised for their own use, were the local villages and the lumber camps. They could sell hay and oats for the horses that worked in the woods, and meat for the men in the lumber camps, for example. Remaining surplus, as the population grew and they had the surplus, could be sold and shipped out. For the upper part of the county, this would mean down the St. John River, possibly, for the southern part of the county, would ship out over the road to Bangor by wagon, covered wagon, to protect the products from the elements. Until the railroads finally came at the end of this century. It took 2 weeks for a truck wagon of goods to go from Prescott to Bangor and for the return trip. Yet many tons of goods were shipped out that slow, cumbersome way in those days. It must have been very tiring, it seems, to 20th century people. Pioneer families occasionally moved in covered wagons. And somewhere around the middle of the century, I'm not sure the exact date, stagecoaches were put on the road between Bangor and Mattawamkeag and Bangor and Halton, and were later extended up to Prescott and other communities as the roads were improved. And eventually, roads were built up to Fort Kent as well. And after the Civil War, the company that had the stage route brought in the latest Texas-style stage coaches, which represented an advance in style and comfort, no doubt. Arista begins to sound like frontier land. Log cabins, stage coaches. There were cattle drives, too. Herds of cattle or sheep were collected by buyers, a local buyer perhaps, or buyers from Bangor or Massachusetts, and taken out walking, transporting themselves to market, as far as Brighton, Massachusetts, for example. They had to follow the roads because, of course, they were forested roads, and they didn't have the wide open range to wander in with the Western cattle drives did. But the rustic was, in those days, very much like the American West. You have the false storefronts, rather like those in large cities you see on TV nowadays, pitching posts outside. There are many inns and hotels along the roads, not just in the villages, but along the long stretches of road between the villages. It was an overnight trip from Halton to Prescott, for example, and the stagecoach ordinarily stopped in Blaine for the night. These inns or hotels account for many of the very large houses that can still be seen along the highways between Aroostook and Bangor. In other communities, near larger logging operations, some of these large houses constituted boarding houses for the men that worked in the mills, for example. Apparently, these were exciting times in many ways. We hear that young boys were fascinated by the stagecoach drivers in this Teamsters and the Dovers who knew who came. The the stagecoach drivers sent me with the heroes here. They always drove the horses with an extra flurry into the town, or less so. They might plod along between the villages, but it was an exciting entry. The next important stage in the history of Arista will be the coming of the railroads. Some of the leaders in the state of Maine, and most of the leaders in Arista County itself, long understood that they desperately needed improved transportation with the outside world if they were going to achieve any real prosperity. The question was, so who would build the railroads and by what route? When railroads finally came in 1870, it was by way of a branch from the New Brunswick Railroad into Holton, and another branch of the same railroad company was extended up the Arista River in the 1870s to Fort Fairfield, Prescott, Caribou. Finally, in the 1890s, the Bangor and Arista Railroad was built, connecting Arista County with Bangor and other American cities. It reached Holton in the 1890s and was extended up to the Arista River Valley and on through Stockholm to Van Buren a few years later. Another branch going up in western Arista towards Ashland was soon built, and it was eventually extended into Fort Kent. Tentative plans to build another branch of the railroad west across Arista, perhaps connecting with railroads in Quebec, were made before World War I, but never came to anything. Later also, branch lines connecting with the Canadian Pacific New Brunswick Railroad branch in the Arista Valley were extended on up the river, reaching smaller towns that the Van Buren Arista Railroad didn't reach. I'm thinking here of Washburn, for example. The result of this railroad building was that soon after 1900, most towns that had been settled in Arista were either on or near a railroad and had direct contact with American markets. This was very important in that it meant that whatever Arista could produce in quantity could be shipped out to American markets. And if they could compete effectively, real prosperity might come. There were certain products in which they found they couldn't compete very effectively. In wheat and flour, for example, dairy products, they couldn't compete. And so you will find after the Bangor and Arista system had become complete, grist mills and flour mills were closing down, cheese factories closed, the carding mills were soon closed in Arista. The western part of the United States could outproduce Arista in any of these products. Armour and Swift could send meat right into Holton to sell, for example. The lumber industry continued and prospered pretty much, with some changes, of course, within the industry, until World War I and after. The opening of the Panama Canal meant increased competition in the lumber industry with West Coast lumber, and the Great Depression of the 1930s hit many lumber companies very hard as well. The lumber camps that continued in operation in the eastern parts of the Arista provided a great deal of employment for men of Arista towns, and their experiences are recorded in quite a good deal of detail in many of the tapes from these Arista towns. The major effect, probably, of the coming of the railroads to Arista was on the raising of potatoes. Right away, starch factories were established in
Fulton and in Caribou, for example, when the New Brunswick Railroad first came in the 1870s, potato starch was in considerable demand for the textile mills in southern New England in those days. The surprise was that there was also a large market for potatoes for eating in the Boston area. Aristic farmers found that they could produce potatoes in large quantities and began to expand their production. And the period of agricultural prosperity for Aristic County really dates from that time. Aristic had unique advantages just then, unique in place and time, apparently. Very good soil. Didn't require very much fertilizer in those days. Now the nutrients have been considerably used out of that soil. Much more fertilizer is used today. The climate of Aristic was suitable for potato growing when it was not suitable for certain other kinds of crops. And the climate was perhaps even advantageous for the production of seed potatoes, since the potatoes could be kept in the large storehouses that became characteristic of the Aristic countryside. Whereas in warmer climates, the potatoes couldn't be kept over the winter for use as seed in another crop, so that Aristic farmers began shipping potatoes out as seed also. Potato growing was not very popular with farmers in the rest of America in the early days, and so there were not many areas in the United States that were producing in competition with Aristic just then. And with the Bangor and Aristic Railroad being available for transportation, there was no transportation handicap as far as the Boston market was concerned. And the result was great expansion in acreage of potatoes in Aristic. This occurs noticeably after 1870, and the expansion continued markedly after the 1890s. It coincides also with the availability of some new machines to make potato growing easier. The potato planter was a tremendous asset. For example, with a planter, one man and two horses could do in one day what it would have taken 10 horses and 15 men to do in the days when they didn't have the planter available. Other changes in the production and handling of potatoes are well covered in these tapes, and I don't see that I need to go into any other detail. One result of the expansion and of the inventions of the potato industry was the export of seed and the development of competing areas for potato production in other parts of the United States. And the potato growers have had in recent years difficulties with that competition. Probably potato raising will never again be as prosperous as it was in those years around World War I and the 1920s. When we started this project, we had in mind the great differences that have occurred in the way of life in this area since the 1890s, within the lifespan of people who are living, who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, but that are beyond the knowledge of the younger generation. We thought that recollections of these changes, what life used to be like, ought to be made available to the young people and the generations to come. I've been impressed in listening to the tapes by how much recognition speakers give, sometimes indirectly, to the effect of the land and of the rivers on their lives. How important the roads were, the railroads, and then how impressive the automobile and the airplane have been to them. The TV now and space travel represent tremendous change in scope for one lifetime. They frequently recall how hard people worked in the days when they were young. But time after time, they seem to agree that, as they put it, we had a good life. Perhaps we were happier then.